This episode of the Wired UK podcast is brought to you by Braintree V.0, the snippet of code that allows you to accept PayPal, Apple Pay, and credit and debit cards in your mobile app or website, all with a single integration. To learn more and to try out the sandbox, go to braintreepayments.com/wired news. Coming up today, an artificial intelligence defeats humans at board games, children defeat adults at inventing, and why conspiracy theories defeat reason and sense. This is episode 252 of the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business, and design. I'm your host, Michael Rundle, and I'm editor of wired.co.uk. Joining me on the show are DJ Jimmy T.
Yo.
That's James Temperton. And Mixmaster Matty B.
I'm really not comfortable with this.
Matt Burgess. The reason I use those names is we've had a bit of showbiz in the podcast world this week. We did a photo shoot for the magazine.
It was very glamorous.
It was. And that's going to be appearing in an issue of Wired coming soon. And podcast alumnus and future star Leah Clark joined us for that photo shoot. And it was great to see her in the office again.
She came in with baby.
It's a lovely baby.
And both are doing very well, but she won't be back for quite a little while yet.
But she does miss the podcast audience, so she asked us to pass on a hello and thanks and well wishes and all the other kind of things that Leah, being a lovely person, would ask us to pass on. Now, Matt, have you learned anything this week?
I've actually learned something this week for a change.
Go on.
I've learned that people are actually smuggling drugs into prisons in potatoes. They're cutting them open and sending them into prisons.
Yeah, but the first thing I think of when you say that is people bringing in potatoes as gifts, like, you know, when they're visiting people. I guess it's more of the catering.
Yeah, I think it's more of the catering. Yeah. I don't think people are sending in baked potatoes as gifts.
We've also, drones is another way people are bringing in drugs to prisons. But I've always wanted to meet someone who would actually fly drugs into prisons. It sounds like an absolutely fascinating job.
James, something that you maybe want to do?
Well, I don't know. It seems like a fun skill. It seems like a kind of thing a guy could get a job
eminently
doing.
Arrestable.
Absolutely. Yeah. I've learned this week that Facebook's entire revenue for 2015, $18 billion, only equates to 90 days of profit if you're Apple.
It's crazy.
It's a lot of money.
But Apple isn't doing very well. Let's not get into that.
What have you learned this week?
I learned how to say quite a complicated and long word, which I'm going to have to read now because I've slightly forgotten it. Fascioscapulohumeral muscular dystrophy, which is three words, but the difficult one is fascioscapulohumeral.
Now, firstly, what is that?
So it's a degenerative muscle disease condition that will pretty much restrict a sufferer to a wheelchair for life. But the reason that I learned to say that is we're recording a new addition of to the podcast. This isn't going very well, but it's a version of the
podcast.
This isn't
an indication of the quality of this next podcast.
No, and I make my voice much deeper. So we're recording stories based on Wired's really brilliant, long, amazingly researched features. So we want to bring them to life as an audiobook, an audio podcast, obviously, so you can download it, listen to it, and a whole different way to consume our journalism.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this. I think that's one thing that Wired does really well in the magazine and online, but here on the podcast, more of a discussion forum. But the ability to, you know, sit back and really engage in one of Wired's great stories over the last few years, really, of our features and the stuff we've got coming up in the next 12 months is going to be really fun. So we're not quite sure when this is going to be hitting the podcast feed.
As quickly as I can correctly say, fascioscapulohumeral muscular dystrophy. So they'll be coming out pretty soon. I've got to finish off recording them and edit it all together, and then we'll be releasing the first couple, hopefully very soon.
And we'll be really interested in your feedback as well. So, you know, is this something you want from the Wired podcast? What do you think? Should it be a part of the current feed or split into a separate feed? And also, as soon as the episodes are out, we'd love to get your feedback as well. You know, tell us about what you want from the Wired podcast in long form and what kind of stories you want us to tell. So it's podcast@wired.co.uk, or you can also reach James on jateemperton on Twitter. So
that's not how you say a Twitter username, @jateemperton.
@jateemperton, okay, fine. All right, let's get on with the news. Matt, computers have beaten humans at board games this week, and it actually matters. Tell us why.
Yeah, so Google, and in particular Google's startup that it purchased for $400 million in 2014, DeepMind, which is using machine learning, artificial intelligence, has beaten a human, and a very good human, a professional human player, at the board game Go.
What is Go?
Go is a ancient Chinese board game. It's 2,500 years old. Some people say it's the oldest board game that's still played in the world today. And it's basically a counters game with black and white counters, and it's territorial. The person who can get the most territory over the game out of two people, so me and yourself playing, James, wins the game, basically.
Why is this so hard for computers to play? Because, you know, speaking as someone who knows nothing really about AI, I'm used to computers beating me at video games all the time and board games. And obviously, IBM famously defeated the best human players at chess quite a long time ago. So why has this taken so long, and why is it so significant?
So this is a discovery and research that has been done over the last sort of 20 years. People have been looking at this, not just Google. Obviously, there have been a lot of other people looking at it, and we'll come on to that. We'll come on to that in a minute. But Google and DeepMind have actually cracked it, because they've managed to work out, basically, they've used trial and error. They've simulated thousands of games. They've looked at the amount of moves that they can make, because there are more moves than chess, which is why one of the reasons why it's taken so long.
It's almost infinitely more moves than chess. It's a huge, huge number of combinations that the artificial intelligence has to wrangle in order to win a game.
And I guess the key word there is intelligence as well. You need a computer that can think through the situation and apply logic to how the board game is going to go, and the different probabilities associated with that. So it's not just the case that you can brute force your way into being good at Go. I mean, in chess, that was famously something that the best Russian players used to attempt to do. It was a form of book learning, that you would learn virtually every chess situation and apply that to matches as you went. With Go, that's virtually impossible. So I guess the key here is a good DeepMind, or whatever version of DeepMind Google's using, is really thinking its way through the games.
Yeah, so the part of the DeepMind which they've been working on, they've created a system called AlphaGo, which is basically using deep neural networks and an advanced tree system, and combining the two layers together, really. And basically, they worked out on one level all the possible moves that could be made, and then sort of looked at the trial and error and how what could happen in the game. And then every time that a move is made, they run simulations and sort of see what's going on into what possible moves could be next.
What do you mean when you say an advanced tree network with an advanced tree search with a deep neural network? Sorry, this is really mean.
Well, that's a complicated one. Basically, it is just a mixture of a search system, and this is not to do discredit, this is me not fully understanding the real science behind this very, very complicated procedure.
Well, I guess part of it is the mystery element, in that this kind of AI, to some extent, programs itself. It's not being programmed at every stage by a human programmer. It is learning and adapting. And
yeah,
part of the fun of it is that there's a certain amount of mystery, even for the people who have created it.
Correct me if I'm wrong, and I don't think I am, but the way a deep neural network works is it's modeled on a human brain. So human brains, if you think about them, are lots of different layers and levels of understanding that we take in context and past experience and visual inputs. And a neural network works in a similar way. It takes a variety of different inputs and filters them through different layers to make sense of them, a bit like a brain, but in a more simplified way, because it can only play Go.
What was funny this week, though, and actually on Wednesday, is that we don't usually write about computers attempting to beat human players at Go, but actually we had two stories on this yesterday, because Google's announcement was preempted by a very similar announcement by a very similar company.
Yeah, so Facebook have been looking at Go as well. And I think there's a bit of friendly competition, to put it mildly, between the two companies. So Mark Zuckerberg posted about maybe 12 hours before Google were going to announce their findings, that they'd sort of preempted, and they've discussed this in public in the past. Mark Zuckerberg posted a video of Facebook's AI competing with Go onto his Facebook page.
Now, the detail of their discovery or their achievement is actually much less significant than Google's. We should say that Google's paper was submitted to Nature, an academic journal, and it really feels like they have gone quite a long way into solving this issue, whereas Facebook, it sounds like, are scratching the surface, although we did get a lot of angry calls, I think it's fair to say, from Google when the Facebook story went up, that Google obviously has something planned for later that day. So I don't know how friendly the competition between Facebook and Google on this really is. It might actually be quite antagonistic.
All competition is good competition.
Yeah, and that's the thing. And everybody who is looking into this sort of area wants to be the first to do it because Go is such a complicated game to try and master with AI. So there is going to be competition between whatever company gets there first, and it looks like it's Google with this because they have beaten the three-time reigning European champion of the game.
And they're going to try even harder next time. They're putting it up against the world champion, aren't they, in a couple of months?
Yeah, so in a couple of months, Google's going to... I guess that's the ultimate test, the world champion. But also, Google's... DeepMind's AI software has actually beaten other software that I don't know what software, but some programs that it's beaten. It's played 500 games against other Go computer programs, and it won 499 of them.
Well,
not a bad record.
But I guess the point being that if you can beat Go, the best human Go players, you can also improve other complex systems like transport infrastructure or computer networks or server problems or all kinds of different computing things can be approached in the same way. Go is really a visual demonstration and a PR-friendly one, but the possibilities for neural networks on other problems are mind-boggling. There were lots of other inventions on wired.co.uk this week, though. Some of them actually, if you're being fair-minded, are more intriguing even than Google's advancements in neural networks. So, a self-hovering skipping rope. That's pretty good, right?
It's not bad.
Yeah. An umbrella for ladybirds? It's trickier to understand, but still pretty decent. And a pneumatic lift to hoist homes out of the path of warmongering dictators, which would be very useful all over the world, I think.
Pretty neat.
Yeah, all amazing inventions. And frankly, if CES in Las Vegas had been this good, we wouldn't have come back, I imagine. But
you've missed off my favourite invention.
We're going to get to that.
Okay.
But I should say that these are real inventions, but they're all designed by school children. So Dominic Wilcox, working with the Cultural Spring, has created a project called the Inventors Project. Now, Dominic Wilcox is someone who has done all kinds of projects with young people, inventions and technology. And this particular project took 600 young people in Sunderland and South Tyneside and basically set their imaginations loose in what I can only imagine was the most fun class in Sunderland that year or that decade. And basically got kids to explore their wildest imaginations and invent stuff. But what's amazing, and I really encourage you to check out this gallery on wired.co.uk, partly because I wrote it and it would be a bit of an ego boost, but they made 60 of these inventions for real.
So their imaginations literally came to life.
Yeah, more or less. And actually, some of the inventions that were put together for this are really very cool. So one that stood out, perhaps arguably the most beautiful and in some ways practical invention, it's called the Shady Lamp. So this was designed by Layla Amir, who is an 11-year-old from Sunderland, and built for real by Carl Gregg at Fab Lab in Sunderland. Fab Lab, another laboratory and makers lab who Wired has worked with a bunch, including at Wired Next Gen last year. And this is basically a lamp that you can adjust, not by adjusting the electricity passing through it, but by adjusting shutters that form the lampshade. So you can turn them in to reduce the amount of light that leaks out and turn them out to increase it. So you've got an adjustable lamp that's actually a beautiful physical object.
So it's the Venetian blinds, right? That's the name of the kind of blind. Is that a Venetian?
I guess so. I think of Venetian being kind of vertical rather than wrapped around something. But yeah, more or less. And that's pretty amazing. You could imagine that being sold in, you know, John Lewis, I think.
I think I'd buy that.
Also designed by Wendy Ridley, who's 9 years old, and made by Roger O'Brien and AMAP, is the Family Scooter, which is basically four scooters attached together.
So it's a quad tandem scooter.
Yeah. And it's amazing. It's really, really fun. And that again, was made for real. And there's a photograph of it. I'm not sure how practical it would be, but the kid in the
corners might be difficult.
But the kid in the picture is loving it, and that's what's so great. As I said, the flipping rope we've described earlier—that's a skipping rope that hovers in midair, so you can skip without having to actually hold the rope, which I guess sounds really fun. I don't skip a lot, but you know.
I mean, it would make you skip more.
I suppose so. One that really stood out by Daniel Shimin, who's a boy who is 4.5 years old, is the shout-activated camera. And what's lovely about this is the drawing he did, which is basically there's like a small blob of colours and then an arrow that says this takes the picture and then another arrow that says you shout. And that's it. It's a shout-activated camera. But what's brilliant is that the version of it that was put together by Alistair MacDonald looks just like it as well.
It's got all the colours and the blobbiness.
Yeah, it's fantastic. But what I love about this project is it's really bringing kids' imaginations to life in a really practical way. And I think shining a light in some ways on the way adults approach invention. I mean, you were saying coming back from CES how much the stuff we saw was putting Bluetooth in a thing or a chip in a thing, and there wasn't really much attempt to reinvent the basics of how we live our lives, but also to have fun. Now, obviously, those are business projects and they have to sell them, but there is a kind of a fun creativity in invention that it sometimes gets lost.
So they're not constrained. I mean, I'll open this question out. Do you guys think that sometimes our minds are too constrained by the way that we've almost trained ourselves to think, and that when you tell kids, design something that you think would be really cool, they come up with these amazing ideas? And there's a real difference there, right?
I think so. I mean, you know, there was one idea in the project which was, you know how when you eat Pringles, in a big long tube of Pringles, you start off and you're enjoying them and they're easy to eat and you're eating and eating and eating. And as soon as it gets to the bottom of the tub, it's impossible to get them out, especially if you're, you know, a kid and you're not very dexterous. Like, it's hard to get them out. Obviously, eventually you learn just tip the tube upside down. But until you get there, it's hard to get them out. So one of the kids in this project invented a lift-up device that you simply insert into the tube, and then it creates a little hook on the bottom, and then you just lift it up, and then all the Pringles come out.
It's an ingenious solution to an ongoing problem.
And I think on a wider point, slightly to broaden it out even more, it just highlights the sort of diversity in the creative thinking process. Like, the more different people you have, whether they are young children, whether they're people of different demographics, people who maybe don't work together all the time, it just sort of broadens thinking and takes us out of our sort of comfort zones of being in the same place and just doing the same routine, doing the same thing every day, and just really expands our minds a bit just by speaking to different people and seeing different ideas and what can be achieved.
I think so. And I think the other thing as well is that we hear a lot about creativity and technology with kids in regard to things like Minecraft, Raspberry Pi, the BBC Microbit, which are all really, really great projects. But ultimately, a lot of them fundamentally come down to kids staring at screens. And what's great about this is it's kids building things and building things that don't necessarily require electricity. Thinking
crayons and paper and imagination.
Right. And once you have that, that really is the skill. You know, the coding and stuff can come later, especially for kids this young, some as young as four. But to be able to sit down and look at an object and think, how can this be reinvented and applied in a different way? That is the core of what makes a company like Apple make $18 billion in profit in 90 days. And, you know, really is going to be the thing we build our future on. So I encourage you to check out the gallery. It's a really fun gallery. Lots of really cool GIFs as well on why.co.uk. But also try and find Dominic Wilcox on Twitter, because he's full of great ideas. The project runs in Sunderland until Friday. So maybe if you're listening to this, it might be a bit too late. But I know they're planning to do other things with this. So check them out on the web and on why.co.uk. James, on a different tack, we covered a story this week looking at immigration in the UK. So tell us about that, and then let's talk about what makes it a Wired story.
All right, so more a study was published this week by Oxford University that found that more than 40% of British workers, so not everyone, just British workers, are too poor to marry a non-EU citizen and live together with them under UK government rules.
Now, we did sort of talk about this in the office when we were looking at this story, because I mean, Wired is a broad church. We can cover all kinds of things, including politics. But typically, we wouldn't necessarily get into an issue like this in such a specific or data-driven way. So tell us why you felt this was a Wired story, and readers, it seemed like, agreed with you.
Yeah, so it's a story about data, and it's a story about inclusiveness and internationalism and the ability of people to freely move around and work and live and love where they please, which I think for me is something that Wired represents. We speak to entrepreneurs and creative people from all walks of life that have come to different parts of the world to try and make it and to try and change the world, which might sound a bit highfalutin, but very often that is the case. And the devil is in the detail of this data. So the data revealed that women and young people are disproportionately affected by the £18,600 threshold. So this is a number set by the government a couple of years ago that means that in order to have, if you have a non-EU spouse and you want them to settle in the UK and they don't have any right to remain in this country, you have to earn over that amount of money.
And it doesn't take into account the amount that person might be making in a job where they currently are, and it doesn't take into account their skills or the potential learning when they get here.
No, it only takes into account that they're not from the European Union, and that's it. So 50% of women and 53% of people under the age of 30 are ineligible to settle a non-EU spouse in the UK. And it's a really difficult issue. So it's going to be going to the Supreme Court in, I think, a month's time, where it will review the policy and judge how the threshold is affecting not just the non-EU migrants that want to come to the UK, but British citizens that fall in love with people that aren't from this part of the world and then can't live with them in this country.
I suppose the one of the issues with this is that it obviously affects different parts of the country in different ways. So we know that average earnings in London tend to be much higher than they are, for instance, in the Northwest. So London is probably going to be less affected by this than a lot of other people who don't live in the capital.
And is, yeah. So the majority of people living in London, 73%, meet this income threshold. Even if they're female, 67%, or under the age of 30, 69%. And it has been proposed and argued that maybe this £18,600 threshold should be varied across the country, so much lower in the northeast and the southwest and Wales perhaps, and much higher in London. But then the counter argument to that, which has been put forward a number of times over the last few years that this threshold has existed, is that, well, people just move somewhere else in order to settle a spouse, and then they'll move to where they actually want to live. But it is so difficult, and as the researchers at Oxford University pointed out, there's no one size fits all. A number is so, while it's exact, it's so inexact, and it means that an awful lot of people are left in limbo.
I guess the other side to this as well is speaking from the tech perspective, in the last couple of years, there's been a fairly high profile case in which Tech City, the government funded organisation designed to promote technology both in London and the rest of the UK, has been given a special provision to issue, I think, up to 200 tier one visas, I think it's that number, to potential entrepreneurs and tech leaders who show extreme potential, and has managed to only, I think, serve, at least in the, there's a certain period when we were writing about this in the summer, it was only up to about 9 that they've actually issued. And so what that is a special provision for people in our world. And I guess what's interesting is this affects people disproportionately who may not already be in the wide world, but might have a huge amount to offer. I mean, you just have to look at the wide events we run. How many people speaking at those are from all over the world? And we definitely think, I think, of the wide world as being a global thing and not just a UK thing. So theoretically, we're missing out on a lot here.
Yeah, so to take an anecdotal example, say if you come to the United Kingdom as a young person to come to university and you're here on a student visa, you then fall in love with someone at university, but then what happens? Well, you can marry them here, but if you don't earn enough straight out of university, and it's very difficult to get jobs coming out of university, then what happens? Do you make your marriage work across oceans, or do you move to another country? So the UK risks losing out on young, ambitious people by, this is my view.
Well, the point about academics, I think, is actually a really good one, in that academics tend to earn relatively low amounts when they immediately graduate, and also tend to meet people and fall in love with people from all parts of the world, because international students is such a significant thing in academic research in the UK.
James, not to put you on the spot too much,
oh, go
but
on.
Do we know if other countries around the world have this type of policy or anything involved?
So I think a good comparison would be America. And America is a lot more difficult as a place to settle. Canada's probably comparatively similar, in places like Australia and New Zealand, probably more similar to the UK. But you've always got the problem of, once you get over a certain age, so there's lots of different ways that you can qualify to live in other parts of the world and go and share experiences and see more of this planet on which we live. But if you don't earn enough or you're over a certain age, you can end up getting shuffled out of all of the available entry routes and then you're stuck. So the UK is kind of typical, but there are definitely worse places and definitely better places.
Well, it's definitely an issue that's going to be in the news over the next 12 months, particularly
right,
in relation to the European Union as opposed to non-EU migrants. But obviously the story about migration is a very big and significant one at the moment. So we'll definitely be following that over the rest of the year from a wide angle. But it's definitely a topic we're interested in. So we're also interested in your feedback. So again, podcast@wired.co.uk. Let us know what you think. Still to come, why the truth, if it really is out there already, probably. Oxford academics have solved the problem of conspiracy theories, and it's not good news for believers. This episode of the Wired UK podcast is brought to you by Braintree, code for easy online payments. If you're working on a mobile app or website and searching for a simple payment solution, Braintree V.0 allows you to accept PayPal, Apple Pay, credit and debit cards, and more, all with a single integration. Just one snippet of code and you're all set up, ready to start taking payments from customers around the world. For more information and to try out the sandbox, go to braintreepayments.com/wide news. We can't wait to see what you make of it. So guys, did NASA really walk on the moon in 1969?
It was Kubrick, wasn't it?
Are aircraft leaving chemtrails in the sky? Is there actually a cure for cancer suppressed by pharmaceutical companies for some reason, presumably? Unfortunately, for the more imaginative conspiracy theorists among us, the answer to all of these questions is no. Research from the University of Oxford has found a reliable way, finally, to tell how long alleged conspiracies could exist without being exposed as fake.
This is cool. It takes all the different bits of conspiracy theory, the number of people involved, the outlandishness of it.
And how much time has passed as well since it came up.
So how does it work?
Well, basically, it puts all of those factors into an equation. And this is one of those pieces of research that sometimes gets misreported. You know, we have an equation for the perfect sandwich, or we have an equation for X or Y. But basically, it puts all of those numbers into a piece of code and comes up with an intrinsic possibility, intrinsic probability, pardon me, of a conspiracy failing. And the data from these examples meant Dr. Grimes at the University of Oxford could calculate the possibility of a given conspiracy being revealed compared to if it happened a million times. So the moon landing, according to this algorithm, would be public in just 3.7 years.
So if it was on a film set somewhere in the American desert, we would have known about it in the early 1970s.
Because it would require 100,000 people to get involved, and it would have been such an enormous thing that someone would blab. Interestingly, climate change fraud was another conspiracy theory he estimated through this research and came up with a pretty broad 3.7 to 26.8 years.
I mean, we're all implicit in the climate change fraud.
Similarly, vaccine and autism, he estimated, could last between 3.2 and 34.8 years. Again, very broad, but estimated that this supposed cure for cancer that exists and is being hidden could only last 3.2 years. This is pretty interesting research, though, because putting some figures around some of these outlandish theories isn't just a question of talking about crazy people. Some of these conspiracy theories are actually getting into the mainstream. I mean, you only really have to look at the political debate currently going on in the US presidential elections to look at how certain conspiracy theories have gotten completely out of control.
But let's be honest, Michael, this study by Oxford University was almost certainly sponsored by those that would wish to hide the truth from us.
Well, I couldn't possibly comment on that. But according to the equation, I wonder if the equation actually worked out how long it would be for the equation to come out as a fraud. I imagine a long time, because only two people, I think, or one or two people were involved in the research. And
it's the perfect ruse.
I guess it got us thinking, though, about conspiracy theories more generally. I mean, they're one of those things that can be really fun to talk about and gets a lot of mockery. But on the other hand, really, really infuriates a lot of people. And rightly so, perhaps in the case of, say, climate change or when it relates to vaccines and autism. And I always remember that famous video clip of Buzz Aldrin being confronted by a moon landing conspiracy theorist and just whapping him straight in the cheek, which, you know, I don't condone violence, but one understands when you have literally walked on the moon.
No, he did walk on the moon.
Buzz Aldrin,
Neil Armstrong, then Buzz, and no, who was the person in
Michael Collins?
Ah, that's it. Sorry.
I mean, don't challenge me on Apollo trivia.
I'll go back in my box.
But it got us thinking about various conspiracy theories that we'd kind of like to start spreading around on the internet, because we have, let's face it, on Wired, a bit of a pulpit, a platform in order to start spreading lies. We try not to, ideally. It's not really in our remit.
So let's kick off. Michael?
Dogs can talk.
What?
Dogs can talk.
All right. Go on.
My conspiracy theory is that dogs can talk. And that everyone who owns a dog talks to their dog secretly, but they're not allowed to mention it because the dogs control the humans.
Matt Burgess, what's wrong with this?
I'm a dog owner, so I can't really comment on this. I've sworn a pact to secrecy.
Well, we've got to pull this lie down.
Well, my theory is that, so, you know, I can't remember exactly how many people in the UK own a dog. I think it's around 5 to 10 million people are of a household with a dog, which is a large number. That might be slightly high, but you know, so that's a large number of people. This has been going on for hundreds of years, but we don't know about it. And I think the only reason we don't know about it is because because it's actually happening. I mean, let's face it, dogs are one of those animals that it feels like people talk to a lot, and you see them in the street already. They're walking around, you know, particularly older people. It's like, oh, how are you, my little buggins? You know, what's your marshmallow? You want a little, you want to rub your feet or whatever? Like, and I don't have a dog, but I assume that the dogs at some point are talking back. And that's my conspiracy theory. And I defy you to prove me wrong.
So our dogs are our secret overlords?
Well, I wouldn't say that. I think they're just sort of communicating. You know, they're issuing their demands. They're slowly manipulating things behind the scenes. It reminds me, when I was thinking of this, of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, where it turns out the mice, there's a couple of pairs of mice, trillions of mice, have been secretly manipulating humanity, forcing like researchers. So they would run down the wrong way and amaze and occasionally die of myxomatosis. And by doing that, manipulate the researchers who would then manipulate the rest of humanity.
But the dogs are showing a massive lack of ambition. If they can communicate on a level of humans, they're doing nothing with it.
Well, I mean, there is the famous, I can't remember who said this, but you know, if an alien were to come down and watch a dog leading a human who is holding a rope and then occasionally stopping and doing their business in a park or pavement that the human then dutifully picks up, they would only conclude that the dog was in charge.
But the dogs are never truly free.
No, but you look at the life of a dog. I mean, they're basically lounging around. They're naked all the time. They're having all the fun. They're getting their food for them. They're warm, safe. They're comfortable.
I like the line, they're naked all the time.
Well, look, I mean, you know, if I could escape the burden of wearing clothes to work, I definitely would. But I just feel like Matt's head would explode. Anyway, I'm convinced of this. James, what do you reckon, if you were to start a conspiracy theory, what would you propose?
Planes don't fly.
Yeah, they do, though, because we can see them.
I live on a flight route, and quite often, every 10 minutes, really, there's one going by, it turns, it banks. I see all sides of it, really, every single side of it. So what is that? What's in the sky?
You can't just say no. You do need some proposal here.
So what you're seeing there are majestic birds. So when we stopped flying Concorde, what actually happened is a bird had gone extinct. That's what had happened.
Okay, so what happens when you're inside a plane, and how do I get off in Los Angeles when I started in London?
Boats.
Very fast boats,
presumably. Very, very fast boats.
That can cross land.
Yeah, so I don't know. When you sit down on a plane and you're kind of getting comfy in your seat, sometimes you'll see vapor appearing on the ceiling of the plane, right? Vapor, right. It's not vapor. That's a gas. That is a very potent anesthetic that is rendering people unconscious so that you can be hoiked off the plane, put on a very sophisticated top secret high speed boat and transported to your destination.
Who is responsible for this, though? Because I mean, at least mine had a clear, you know, a clear person who was behind the conspiracy.
Mm.
So who is doing this and why?
Well, we've always been able to fly planes, but it just turned out that the idea was so expensive and so ridiculous that boats seemed like a better option.
Okay.
I mean, why fly?
Sure. I'm not convinced, frankly, but you know, I think maybe you could find a willing audience. We were hunting around some of the conspiracy theory sites on the internet, including David Icke's website.
This one is so good.
It is a fantastic conspiracy. Why don't you let us know what it is?
It's just brilliant. Richmond sausages are tracking you. Every time you buy a Richmond sausage, it's just so good. Yeah.
But what I like, you know, and part of the reason we're discussing this as well is there's been a fairly prominent Twitter spat this week in which a rapper has been dueling with Neil deGrasse Tyson, the American astrophysicist and media commentator, proposing the idea that the Earth is flat. Now, this guy, the rapper whose name is B.O.B.?
Bob. Yeah, let's call him Bob.
It turns out, a fairly odious person for some other beliefs he has. It's a very serious and damaging and upsetting conspiracy theories. But the flat Earth one, I do think, is interesting from a wide perspective, because the flat Earth debate has always been about it's a thought experiment. Can you prove through logic alone that the Earth is round? And if a logical, if ridiculous answer to your points or questions can be found, then you have to re-examine your own logic, your own basis for evidence. And that's kind of a useful thing for people who think about science to do.
So this is a bit like trying to hold a rational conversation with Donald Trump.
Well, yeah, but also if you do believe the Earth is round, and we haven't canvassed the panel here, you know, you should be able to explain it and prove it in purely logical terms. Matt, I wonder.
I've flown around it.
Did you fly?
Oh, well, sorry, I just shouted very loudly. Did I?
Oh boy. Okay. Well, let's get this over with. Come on, Matt. Tell us about your conspiracy theory.
But this one isn't a conspiracy theory because it is true. The London Eye is actually a giant satellite. Not satellite. Satellite dish, and it's speaking to space.
Is it GCHQ related?
I don't know. It could be the dogs who are in charge.
Right, of course.
I just feel like Matt desperately wants to bring up Theresa May.
No, not
which we've so far got through the podcast without bringing up.
What's it doing with space?
So the London Eye, all the cables connected to all the pods, they're actually powering the centre of the London Eye. And when nobody's looking, and because it's invisible, obviously, these beams are being sent up to space and communicating with aliens.
Why not just use a satellite dish?
Because it has to be in the centre of London. London is that part of London is specific place that is got a very high trajectory for talking to space.
I like this one. I think this is a good one. Because, you know, it's an obviously ridiculous object. And I don't know anyone who's been on the London Eye in the last 10 years.
I've been on the London Eye.
Not in the last 10 years.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I know you, but you're the only one. But, like, it seems like a ridiculous thing to build in the centre of London. It feels like there should be another use for it. I have another conspiracy theory that suggests that the Shard is growing and no one can stop it. And that's why they had to build it, because it was growing.
I like the idea that all skyscrapers are growing and we can't stop them. That they're actually bits of Earth.
I think probably Matt's is the most believable of those three conspiracy theories. I mean, you've already admitted yours is wrong.
Well, is it, though? Is it?
Well, I could believe that there is a separate use for it, in so much as throughout history, and London actually, if we could put my London history hat on.
Please don't.
Is full of monuments which have a double purpose. So the monument itself, built in the wake of the Great Fire of London, is a very tall... obviously, it's a monument designed by Christopher Wren and the Royal Society, but it has a secret second purpose, which is that it's a telescope. And the idea was that you could sit at the bottom of the monument and watch a very, very small window at the top of the monument, about 130 feet up in the air, and see the same spot of sky. And over the course of the year, you could see the stars move through that small portion of space and record it and tell something about how space works. And so actually, that's pretty much what you've just described about 400 years ago.
Yeah, the London Eye is a modern-day monument.
Apart from it's a big corporate Ferris wheel.
This has made me very happy because I got to bring up I got to bring up the Royal Society.
It was excellent.
I'm
Ren.
I'm buzzing. Okay, well, so maybe none of these particular conspiracy theories are true, but we're interested in what you think about conspiracy theories. What are your favourites? What are your most irritating? And how do you explain to someone who is a believer, say, that the NASA astronauts didn't land on the moon? How do you explain? What are your strategies for getting across reality? Let us know. podcast@wired.co.uk.
Just to go back, with the moon landing one, surely we could take a picture of the flag on the moon.
You'd be surprised. It's actually only very, very recently that the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter has managed to take a picture of the moon landing site. But what you could do much further back was shine a laser at it. So a laser shined at the landing site returns back to Earth in the exact amount of time it would take a laser to get there and back. So you can actually do that.
Right. So that kind of
ruins the conspiracy
gets
theory.
Gets rid of that one.
Well, I think the conspiracy theories for that actually say that humans did land on the moon, just not in 1969. They did it 6 months later.
And it was the Russians.
Yeah. Well, anyway. Well, I mean, it would be much harder to tell if we ever land on Mars. That's the one, really. If you're going to fake something, fake Mars. No one will ever be able to check.
No, because you'll just reboot one of the dead rovers on Mars when you lose communications. And it'll all work out because you'll have some duct tape and some potatoes.
Okay, well, it sounds like is we're not going to be hired to manage any large-scale conspiracy theories anytime soon.
Speak for yourself.
But that's all for this week. So let us know your feedback, as ever, podcast@wired.co.uk. And on Twitter, I'm @MichaelRundle. James?
I am @DJ Jimmy T or whatever it was. No, I am @JTemperton.
And Matt?
I am @MattBurgess1.
And we will speak to you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye.